because I am Tolkien!
Hello. I'm the Doctor.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of Bad Wolf Radio, a discussion and review podcast all about Doctor Who. I'm one of your hosts, Aaron Goins, and I'm here with the man who could watch Matt Smith eat scones all day, Adam Farmer.
Okay, there I go again. I say it every stinking time, don't I? I say that it was totally unexpected every stinking time. But yeah, I can totally watch Matt Smith eat scones all day long. They're delicious. Scrumptious, even.
And that's not a completely random comment. It is in reference to something that we will talk about. But yeah, so we're here. We're going to review the next episode, the second part of The Hungry Earth, which is called The Cold Blood. We're going through the Chibnall episodes. Not a lot going on in the world of Doctor Who right now. Not a lot of news. We have a couple things we're going to talk about before we jump into the review. So first off, John Barrowman is talking about Doctor Who again?
Yeah, not exactly. It's more that John Barrowman has everybody talking about Doctor Who. So best known for his role as Captain Jack, not only in Doctor Who, but also Torchwood. He has fandom right now on the edge of our proverbial seats, waiting to see if he might possibly at some point potentially show back up in Doctor Who.
I know we had talked about before about Alex Kingston, who had said, you know, kind of at a convention, hinted at coming back, and we both were a little like, you know, this is just kind of typical of these actors that have been in Doctor Who. They like to drop the hint, or they like to tease the audience, but more often than not, it doesn't really mean anything. But lo and behold, River Song did come back. So maybe there is something to be said for John Barrowman kind of dropping hints about Doctor Who.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really curious. It would make sense. I have this feeling like he needs to come back at some point. It was a similar situation with River Song, right? We had this feeling that her story really wasn't done, or at least we hadn't really said goodbye to her character. It was kind of hit and miss. I feel pretty much the same about Captain Jack, that I don't feel like we've ultimately put the final nail in the coffin, or we watched the final breath of the face of Bo, however we want to put that one, if that makes any sense at all. But I don't feel like we've seen the end of him. And then, so how it goes is, supposedly there was some hint that he dropped about being in Cardiff. And so people jumped on board with that, and lo and behold, it was for some comic book, I believe, that he was doing with his sister. And so they showed up for that, and then as he was leaving, he posted a video on social media of him saying that he was coming back to Cardiff, which, for a reason he couldn't say, the secrecy of Doctor Who, if you will, possibly. And then that has the rumor mill churning out, oh, he's going to be returning in the Christmas special. This can happen. It would be a fitting end to Moffat, because Captain Jack is a character that Moffat introduced. So why not have Moffat end and Captain Jack end at the same time? There is all sorts of stuff. And then there was also a mention by Capaldi, Capaldi's doctor in series 9, where he says that he's traveled with one other immortal, Captain Jack. So, hey, could that all be leading up to him showing up in the Christmas special? I guess we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, he was kind of referencing or talking to Lady Me about the possibility of her crossing his path, right?
Crossing that is right.
Captain Jack's path. So, yep. Yeah, I had kind of thought about that reference too, thinking, oh, you know, maybe they knew he was coming back for season 10, so they dropped that in there on purpose. I don't know. Are you wanting to see this character back again, or, you know, you think we've had enough of him?
Yeah, I think that's the question that I've been dealing with in my own mind is like, do I really want to see him back? And we had this discussion about River, right? Do we want to see her back, or do we just want to say so long and not have that show back up again? With Captain Jack, and kind of the way that they've approached Capaldi, like we've mentioned it before that there are just bits and pieces. Small parts of previous doctors that just show up. You know what? If Captain Jack shows back up, depending on the story that they put him in, depending on the ending that they give him, I could probably roll with that. I don't think I'm gonna roll my eyes and turn off my TV, especially with it being a Christmas special. I'll watch it. If Captain Jack shows up, it would give us something else to talk about.
Yeah, I always liked the character, and I'd be fine with him coming back at some point. I guess he never came back with Smith, so his last time was with Tennant, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so yeah, I think it's time. If we're gonna bring him back, why not now? But I do think that the hint that he's dropping or whatever he's, oh, he's gonna be back in Cardiff, could really mean anything. I definitely don't think we should be reading into that he has anything to do with future filming of Doctor Who, but it did bring up the subject, of the character, which I think is interesting to talk about. But if I had to guess, I'd say that's not any indication that he's going to be in Doctor Who.
Yeah,
There has to
if
be other
any,
things in Cardiff other than Doctor Who filming, right?
I
Like
mean, hey, you never know. To me, I'm kind of in line with you. To me, it just kind of lends itself to where we are in regards to Doctor Who, the timeline in between seasons, really nothing else to talk about. He can get a lot more traction now when there's a lot less news going on. So yeah, I'm wondering if it might just be. Might be more of an attention grab. Nothing against that. I mean, hey, more power to him. He can command that type of attention, but I don't know if it necessarily is what everybody's thinking it might be.
Yeah, if you've ever seen John Barrowman at a convention, it's not beneath him to go for a cheap attention grab.
He's got that personality, right? Like he can command an audience. He can steal the spotlight. And hey, that's a gift right there. And he knows how to work it.
So there were some other, I guess, former companions that showed up in something, right? We were kind of talking about this before we started recording.
Yeah, so
Missy and Amy and Rory were together.
Yeah, that total random picture on Instagram. But Melissa Gomez published a Instagram photo of her with Amy and Rory. Who would have imagined? A nice little selfie that popped up. To be honest, I'm not entirely sure the story behind it. It was one of those things where it's like, wow, those are faces that seem slightly out of place together. I don't know exactly how to reconcile this in my fandom's mind. But yeah, Missy and the Ponds all together. And
Huh.
it looked like they had a fantastic time.
Now that would get me more excited for, once again, this is probably no indication that, Amy and Rory or the actors that play them are going to be a part of Doctor Who anytime soon. But the idea of them being with Missy, being with Melissa Gomez, it's kind of like, oh wow, how cool would that be if, maybe the Christmas special coming up involves a cameo of Amy and Rory and, they're just going to surprise us with it, that kind of thing.
Yeah, if Moffat does some like you I mean you're a fan of Survivor. You know one of the last episodes where they walk and they see all the torches and everything like that, and they have these flashbacks to everybody that's come before and everybody that has left. What if Moffat does one of those crazy things where he basically goes through all the characters that have shown up on the show and the Doctor has this grand flashback at Christmas time of all the characters and Rory and Amy just happen to appear, and Missy is there as well. I don't know. I have this feeling that Arthur Darvill and Karen Gillan have a few extra things on their plate with DC shows and Marvel movies. It's funny to see them go their separate comic book ways.
Yes. I don't know. I guess if there was ever going to be that type of moment, for, you know, Moffat's era of Doctor Who, it would be probably at the end of his run. So what, that's the end of season 10, right? Okay. So we're getting one more full season with Moffat.
Yeah, now that one more full series.
Now that we've done our fact checking that we may or may not leave in the episode. So we get full season. So I'm thinking, you know, maybe this isn't something that's completely out of the question. When, you know, Tennant had his big goodbye, they did kind of do a big farewell tour. You know, he saw Rose, he saw Martha and Mickey together. He saw Captain Jack. He went and saw Donna for the last time and her family. Like, he did that whole farewell tour before he regenerated. So, you know, maybe we have quite a bit of time until the end of season 10 now. So if they want to do some kind of big final episode for that Doctor, or even just kind of as a goodbye to Moffat, maybe they do bring back people like Rory and Amy to kind of say their goodbyes.
I'm wondering if Rory, Arthur Darvill, would pull a Eccleston and say he's done, he's moved on.
Maybe, and maybe even Amy would too, but you would have to think they built some sort of a relationship with Moffat. From the sounds of what, you know, you see behind the scenes stuff, it seems like everybody got along really well.
Yeah.
So I couldn't, you know, I could see it kind of being almost in a tribute to him more than the Doctor, you know, them coming back kind of as a final, you know, goodbye to that era of Doctor Who and handing it off to Chibnall.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I mean, it'd be fun to get that final farewell tour. You know what? Moffat has done amazing things for Doctor Who, so he deserves something like that.
Yeah, he definitely, it's worthy of saying his, you know, he had an era, you know, of Doctor Who. You know, Davies had his time, and I think Moffat really put his stamp on quite a bit of Doctor Who, you know, before we handed off to Chibnall. You know, so I think it'd be very interesting to see what they are going to do with, you know, kind of his last few episodes, if it's going to become almost a big event, almost like an anniversary would be. And maybe they do kind of pull out some stops and, you know, give us a big, big episode with people maybe we're not expecting to see.
Now I'm getting excited. Like, I could, anytime you make a big shindig out of Doctor Who, I'm all for it. Give me more anniversary specials. Give me more mixing of doctors. Give me more mixing of companions. I'll take it all.
All right, so one last thing, almost just for fun, but we had talked about Matt Smith. We're watching the Matt Smith episodes again right now as we're going back through these Chibnall written episodes. The last couple have been Matt Smith. I'm kind of getting nostalgic for the guy, forgetting. I feel like I forgot how much I liked him as the Doctor. But he has been doing other things now, and one of the recent films that he's been in is Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, which admittedly is something I wasn't planning on watching, but you sent me a clip, and I'll let you kind of explain what the clip is, but it's having me second guess. Maybe I do want to watch this movie now.
No, I'm right there with you. Like, this is one of those movies that really I never gave a second thought to. Like, it's not on my list. Seemed like there would be an opportunity to watch it. Never really a compelling reason to watch it. And then I come across this article where its title seriously is, "We Can and Will Watch Matt Smith Eat Scones All Day." and what it is it's essentially a blooper reel of Matt Smith being Matt Smith as the Reverend in Pride and Prejudice, and he's just eating scones and talking about scones. And I watched this thing like 3 or 4 times. I can't stop watching it. I want to see this movie now. So I pass it along to you because I got such a chuckle out of it. And yeah, it's a funny video.
Yeah, I wasn't really familiar with the role that he was playing in this movie. I'd seen trailers and never once saw him in the trailer, so I assumed he's not playing a very prominent role. But now that you sent me this clip, it seems like he's playing, you know, a very lighthearted role in the film. He's not playing a very serious character, which is kind of what we're used to from his version of the Doctor. So it was a little bit like watching the Doctor in these scenes. So yeah, I'm definitely interested enough now, you know, maybe one night when I'm bored, I'll rent it and just to kind of see Smith. I'm not that interested in the movie, but to see Smith play that role, I think it would be kind of fun.
Yeah, and for anybody that actually knows the books, Pride and Prejudice, I'm sorry, I misspoke. He plays Parson Collins, a potential suitor for Elizabeth Bennet. So he's a suitor of one of the daughters in Pride and Prejudice, and he likes scones.
Yeah, I don't know if there's anyone else of note in that movie, actor-wise.
I think and her name's escaping me, but the girl that plays Cinderella in the new Cinderella movie Disney is in it as well, which I was really surprised about because, hey, Cinderella was a pretty darn good movie. And then she kind of transitioned directly from that into Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, which in my mind didn't necessarily strike me as a blockbuster.
I thought
that was kind of one of those interesting ones. But
she was kind of known for her role in Downton Abbey, which is a very popular show that has now since finished. But I think maybe she was starting to take some of these roles around the same time. So I'm guessing that the filming of Cinderella and probably the filming of Pride and Prejudice and Zombies probably were close together. And maybe she even had accepted both roles. Kind of overlapping, so fresh off of a TV show, usually actors and actresses aren't as picky of what kind of films they go for. But now that she's established herself, we probably won't see her in something like Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. But you know, it was one of her first movies, so we can give her a pass.
We'll give her a pass. Well, I mean, hey.
But Matt Smith should have known better.
Everybody's saying this movie is incredible now. So, I mean, well, we might as well watch it.
We'll see. We will be the judge of that.
We're going to do our entire review show on Pride and Prejudice.
No, we're not going to do that. all right. So, continuing on with our Chibnall reviews, we had done the first part of The Hungry Earth. It's a two-parter. We decided to break it into two parts in our review as well. So,
which was tough for us because based on Series 9 splitting two-parters into two podcasts, we found ourselves being a little bit critical of the episodes. So this was actually a big deal for us to split these reviews into two parts.
Yeah, I think there isn't that many episodes written by Chibnall. So I kind of wanted to spread it out and not, you know, be done with it so fast. Because I think we only have, a couple more after this.
Two more. We have The Power of Three and we have Dinosaurs on a Spaceship.
All right. So and they're both Smith episodes as well. So we get some more Smith, which is going to be cool. But, yeah. So this one kind of jumps right into the story where we left off. The 11th Doctor. And his kind of companion at this time, what was her name? Let me pull up the cast list here so I can get.
I want to call her Nazreen.
Nazreen,
there we go.
Yes, Dr. Chaudhry. She was there with him. And so all the stuff happening with the drilling, they have now ended up, you know, in this whole other world underground where the lizard people live. The correct name, the Silurians.
Nah, lizard people.
Lizard people. Well, doesn't Homo Reptilia.
There you go.
Yes.
Homo Reptilia.
Doesn't Nazreen call them lizard people at one point? And the Doctor corrects her?
Yeah, I think a lot of people refer to them as lizard people because when Mo starts pulling Elliot out of essentially stasis, he's like, and there's lizard men, and the one doctor waves happily. So,
I was happy to see
lizard people,
because then I kind of always felt bad about calling the character the lizard lady, you know, our favorite lizard lady with her potato man friend.
Yes,
you know, I always kind of felt bad saying that, but now that I hear characters in Doctor Who kind of using the same references, like, okay, maybe it's okay.
And not only that, but the lizard people seem to be pretty accepting of it as well. Like, I mean, they call us apes. We call them lizard people.
True, they were throwing it back, yeah. But yeah, so I don't know. There's a lot kind of going on in this episode. I hadn't really remembered much about this story, so it was interesting to kind of rewatch it so many years later. And there was some really cool stuff I thought that happened. Like, I don't know even where to begin, but I thought it was funny with the doctor when they're kind of going through this process of decontamination. They're kind of making sure that I guess the humans are clean or the apes are clean before they dissect them. And the doctor is kind of like, you know, oh, I'm not an ape. I'm not ape at all. You know, he's basically saying he's an alien. And I thought that was interesting. He says something about kind of, don't take the germs for me because it's half of what's keeping me alive.
Yeah. Yeah. I caught that too. I thought it was interesting.
It's an interesting way to say it. And I don't know if that was like a clever reference to him being half human.
Yeah.
Or if maybe I'm just completely misreading it. Because Doctor Who has kind of always ignored the fact that the Doctor, you know, during the Eighth Doctor made-for-TV movie, they dropped the fact that the Doctor was half-human. But then, since then, the Doctor Who, you know, television series has kind of ignored that and, you know, kind of almost tried to wipe it away. But with Capaldi, they brought that idea back. Because Capaldi says to Lady Mi at one point that, you know, he was maybe half-human. So, I don't know. I just thought that was kind of interesting that he said that. And maybe I'm just reading way too into that comment.
I don't know. Because as you look at it or as you watch that scene, it is one of those things that's just kind of like tossed out there. But when you stop and you think about it, I don't know what else he could be meaning. Like, why he's saying, I'm alien. I'm not the same. Don't do the decontamination. And then on the flip side, he's saying that don't kill it because that's like that half of me is keeping me alive. Like, I don't know how else to, I don't know. I can't think of any other way for us to interpret it at this point. I would love to hear if anybody else has any thoughts on it, but to me, it seems like that is the only thing it could be.
And then did you catch the celery reference?
I caught the celery reference, but what is the celery reference for?
Oh, you're a bad Doctor Who fan.
I know. What did I miss?
We haven't gotten to this Doctor yet. The Fifth Doctor always carried a celery in his pocket. As a way to cure himself from being poisoned.
I've seen memes.
Yes. I thought that was a pretty funny reference to the Fifth Doctor. I've only seen a little bit of the Fifth Doctor, but I do remember that. So asking if anyone had celery, I thought that was pretty funny.
Yeah. I'm really puzzled as to why when I watched this the first time, it was so forgettable. And yet going back and watching it a second time, it's a really solid two-parter. Like, it is a really good two-parter. And I don't know if it's just because, like, there were so many big moments in this, especially at the end. There's one huge, huge thing that impacts essentially the entire series for this Doctor that, like, I just missed the entire part of it. Like, I don't know. I'm trying to figure out why such a good two-parter I just completely blank out on.
Yeah, this one didn't really stick with me either, through a first viewing, whenever that was, you know, however many years that was ago. Maybe 5 years ago, probably, I watched this. And I don't think back on these fondly. You know, there's certain episodes, you know, like... I'm trying to think, like, with Smith, you know, 11th Hour, or...
I love the Rebel Flesh.
Yeah, I know you love the Rebel Flesh stuff. You love the Lodger. You know, there's, you know, the Pandorica stuff with Smith. There's one of my favorite episodes I actually just watched last night was the one with, what's his name? The artist.
Yeah, Van Gogh.
Van Gogh. Yeah, Vincent and the
Doctor.
Oh,
my goodness.
Like, one of my favorites all time. Like, certain ones that are just, like, I go back to. You know, I rewatch from time to time. Just love them. And then there's other ones that just, for whatever reason, they're forgettable, and I just never go back and watch them again. These two fall in that category for me. Hungry Earth, Cold Blood, never went back and watched them until now, you know, because they're Chibnall episodes. But otherwise, I probably never would have gone back and watched these.
Same here.
But yeah, you're right. I didn't remember them being this good. But yeah, I thought it was a pretty solid episode across the board.
Now there's big parts in the story that we can definitely touch on, but I want to know, like, what about the Doctor sticks out to you in this episode?
I think because I'm just so used to watching Capaldi, it's the way the Doctor interacts with humans, with the other people, and the way he interacts with his, with his companions. It's just, it's really interesting to see the differences. I could never see Capaldi's version of the Doctor, you know, kind of, and you were talking about what happens at the end, and I kind of want to save that to the end, but there's a scene in the end where the Doctor is talking to Amy and trying to console her in a situation that she's going through, and like he's got his hands on her head and he's like pushing his forehead against hers, and you know, it's very intimate, very, you know he just cares about this character, and it's like, wow, this is the 11th Doctor, you know, the 12th Doctor, I could just never see him doing that, you know. He has lost touch, I feel like, through his regeneration, has lost touch with humanity. But this version of the Doctor is very in touch with humanity.
Yeah.
So that was kind of the big thing that stuck out to me.
It also seems like he's, he enjoys, he's amused by those around him. There's a scene where Rory and the mom, her name is slipping me, and then the granddad, his name is slipping me, but they're like, they're getting ready to be executed. The lizard people show up on the TV in the chapel, and like they're having this conversation, and Matt Smith in the background, even in this like super tense situation, he's kind of just like joyfully, don't listen to her. Rory, you handle this. Like he's just very upbeat and like kind of amused by the entire situation. Whereas Capaldi's Doctor kind of like he's just sick of everything. Like nothing's amusing to him unless it's some brilliant thing he's thought of. I don't know. I definitely see the interactions, like you said, totally different, a lot more intimate, but also like more upbeat. And maybe that is because he's kind of lost touch with it.
Do you remember Capaldi's first episode where he is just angry at the humans for killing the dinosaur?
Yes.
And he calls them apes or monkeys, I think. You stupid apes.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah, so it's kind of like he has taken on that role of the lizard people or the Solarians or however you pronounce it. You know, he's kind of taken on that role now where he views humans as being almost inferior to other life forms that he's met with, and you know, he doesn't like humanity as the 12th Doctor. The 11th Doctor in this episode, he's trying to get the Silurians and the humans to kind of reach an agreement so they can coexist, and he's praising, you know, the Silurians are like, oh, why would we want to you know, do this now that this person has killed one of our own? And he's kind of like, don't use her as just a representation of all of humanity. There's so much good, you know, there's so many good humans out there. And so I could, you know, once again, never could see Capaldi giving humanity that much credit. He's always the one that's really, you know, kind of down on humans for the most part. So yeah,
Smith is full of hope. There's so much hope to be found in the world. There's so much potential, so many possibilities. And it feels like Capaldi's Doctor has come to the conclusion that, you know what, I've seen the end and there really is nothing good. Like they destroy everything, they corrupt everything, they ruin everything, they kill all the aliens. they're not a good people.
I was gonna say, this is still pretty early, you know, in Smith's, you know, this is season one of Smith, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so maybe this is, we're early enough on where he's, you know, still positive, but there's a lot that's still going to happen to the 11th Doctor as well, you know, which is maybe what leads to him becoming so cynical as the 12th.
Yeah. On the flip side, though, he was absolutely brutal when he talked to the Ambrose mom. To Ambrose, thank you. And he was like, what did you do? You were far less than the best of humanity. Yeah. Like, just downright crushed her at that point in time, and he never comes back from it. Like, he's like, don't judge her. like she messed up, but don't grind it in her face. It's never like this forgiveness. He just absolutely crushes her.
Yeah. And who knew that a taser would kill a lizard lady?
Well, it sounds...
she kind of dug it into her a couple times.
Yeah, it sounds like we only saw a part of it, because she said, I kept on asking her and she would never give me the information. And it's like, how long was this going on? How much did you actually lose it? And I have to say, based on our last podcast, I was totally wrong. Alea does not kill everybody and take over. It's another lizard lady that looks almost identical to her.
Who is also played by Neve McIntosh.
Oh, really? She plays Restek too?
Yes.
she plays every all lizard three lady. Lizard ladies.
they just found such a good actress that could play that part. They gave her all three parts.
Which, come to find out, she recently did an interview, and I think she interviewed for the part of Jenny, the second go around. And they were like, nope, you make a pretty good lizard lady. And they made her Vastra.
Wow. See, now I want to... It's been long enough since I've even seen, you know, kind of how Vastra is introduced to the series. I think she's introduced in A Good Man Goes to War.
Yes. Yep. Or that's, Demon's Run. Is it Demon's Run or Good Man? I know it's a two-parter
as well. Yeah, it's in that storyline. And I remember kind of that being the first time I saw her. And even at that time, I was far enough removed from this storyline that I was kind of unsure on if we had seen her before. But now it's kind of all being cleared up. You know, it's three separate characters all played by the same actress, with variations in the way they look, but you know, pretty much they all look the same, even in the makeup.
Yeah.
So maybe, and maybe we know this and I'm just not remembering, but is Vastra related to these characters? Is she like another of this pod of Silurians that were all in stasis, and she just came out of stasis at some point?
I feel like I need to go back and watch it. Okay. Because like, yeah, I don't know. And to be honest, I don't ever think I knew they were different. Like, I don't know.
I just remember seeing Vastra and thinking we've seen her before, which we had. We'd seen the actress before, and we'd seen the actress in lizard makeup, but we had not seen the character before.
I will say this. Restek had a scar across her eye.
Yes.
Which allowed me to be able to say, okay, that's not Alea.
And Alea, I think, had like brown spots kind of in her scales that Vastra doesn't. Vastra's all green, I think. So I'm just trying to think of visual cues so I can tell in the future which one I'm looking at.
That one has a mole above her right eye.
I don't think lizards have moles. But
skin tags.
Right. So, yeah, it's kind of... It's an interesting type of story, you know, where you have this other civilization that actually came to Earth first, and then humans came and kind of messed everything up. They thought the moon was going to hit the Earth, I guess, so they put themselves into this 300-year hibernation.
Yeah.
Is that right?
And later we find out that, like, no, the moon isn't going to hit the Earth. The moon's just a giant egg.
That's true. They knew something was wrong with the moon.
They knew something was wrong with that moon.
They didn't guess right. They instead of it being some kind of, you know, falling object, it was an egg with a dragon inside of it.
Yeah, I mean, it was essentially them just in bigger form.
Right. They should have tied that in. You know, this is a perfect opportunity to tie in that episode.
We just retconned it for them. It's okay.
So you kind of have, you know, it's kind of parallels to, you know, our own history with kind of the way that, you know, the Native Indians were here in America first. The colonists or the settlers came in and kind of took over without any right to take over the land. So some parallels there, but it's an interesting story because you have some of the lizard people. There's not very many of them because most of them are still in stasis, but the ones that have been released from stasis, you have a scientist, you have Restak, who is kind of a leader of the military. So two different points of view. One is peaceful, science-loving. The other one is not so peaceful, war-loving. And then a random politician guy shows up at some point.
Eldaine. Eldaine is the elder, and Malachi is the scientist dude.
Right. So there's not too many of these lizard people for them to deal with because most of them are still, you know, in stasis. But it's kind of interesting to see, you know, the negotiations that are going on and, you know, oh, we can't have you guys come live up on the surface with us because we have, you know, limited resources anyways. And if all of you show up, then, you know, they were kind of implying there's a lot of them.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not like there's just a couple hundred, you know, we're talking about a full civilization that's been living underground.
And not only that, but one thing that Nesrine Chaudhry mentioned was like, what happens when they start to breed and they grow? Like,
she was kind of rude.
Yeah, no, she definitely was. And then Amy's like, well, let's stick them in the deserts. And yeah. She's like, that's a good idea.
Yeah, the outback, the Sahara, we're not using that stuff. Lizards can survive in the desert, right?
Yeah, I mean, hey, they were doing their best to negotiate. They already said that they weren't prepared for it. But come on, y'all. Like, let's not put the lizard people in the deserts. Let's not say, here's the crust of my bread. You can have this.
Right.
So, but I mean, in the end, it ended well. I honestly liked that part about the doctor. I mean, he gave his speech about fixed points in time. This wasn't one of them. It was a tipping point. You have the opportunity to change what the future looks like. And not only that, but like his excitement over, I never thought I would say that, like, there's Homo reptilia and humans all at the same table having a discussion. He was excited about it. Again, that hope in humanity that it seems like Matt Smith, at least at this point, has. And then everything falls apart when they find out that they killed Alea, and things just go from bad to worse. Malachi, the scientist, he gets killed when Restak charges in and with guns, and then crazy Eldaine guy decides to poison his own people if they don't get back into stasis, and then the doctor just runs.
Which wasn't necessarily, I don't know, it seemed like not too bad of an idea because
he
was just
forcing. Definitely crushed the rebellion.
Yeah, he knew his people weren't ready.
Yes.
For this change. You know, they were too warlike, I guess, at this point. Restak, you know, had too much power, and then, you know, if they had allowed the two civilizations to merge at this point in time, it would have been a disaster, it seemed like. And so I think the decision to release the poison wasn't in any way to harm anyone, but more just to force people to kind of go back into stasis.
Yep.
Yeah.
Exactly. Sorry, I tried to destroy his character, but
yeah, I had to defend him. You know, you were saying very mean things. But I was kind of wondering if it was, you know, I don't know the civilization that well. Maybe I need to do a little bit more research into this alien species as they are in Doctor Who. But it seemed like the soldiers were all women, and then like the scientists and the politician were men. So I don't know if this race, you know, maybe the women are kind of more the warlike, you know, of the two sexes. I don't know. It just, or maybe it just happened that the characters we saw that were soldiers were all women.
Yeah, I don't know. The only way I could tell them apart was one had bigger faces.
Well, most of the soldiers had helmets or the masks on the whole time, so I guess yeah. You're not sure, but just based on the shape of the bodies, it did seem like even those were women. But it was.
I'll give that to you. I'll give it to you.
Yeah, it was interesting to kind of see the way that this society seemed to be set up.
So like thinking back to the last episode, when it ended, it showed us like a city right? Like, it seemed like there was a city there.
Yeah, like an underground city, sure.
But they're all asleep. So why do they need a city if they're just in stasis? And then when they come out of stasis, why can't they just stay in their city? Why do they need to come to the surface?
I think they had built the city. Like, they were already there for a while and until they decided to go into stasis because the moon was going to fall on them. So I think they were there for some time.
If the moon falls on you and you're asleep, it still kills you, right?
I'm forgetting the details. Like,
I know, something's not adding up in my
mind. When they explained
sure
it in the episode, it made sense to me.
Yeah.
They thought, their scientists thought the moon was coming and was going to collide with them. And for whatever reason, they felt like they needed to put themselves into stasis. But maybe they thought it would help them survive the collision? I don't know. Yeah, you're right. I don't remember. I don't remember why it made sense, but for whatever reason, it did.
Maybe it was their form of a bomb shelter and they were waiting for after the apocalypse and then they'd come out and figure out what's going on.
Right. Hmm.
I'm trying to see if I can
pick it out of the plot summary here. The Doctor explains the nature of the Silurians' hibernation to Nazarene. Centuries before, their astronomers predicted a planet was on a crash course for Earth, so they hibernated below the surface to avoid the catastrophe. The planet was, in fact, the moon coming into alignment. Malachi is impressed with the Doctor's knowledge of their race, blah, blah, blah. So I think that's just the explanation. You're right. It doesn't make sense. Why would they survive just because they're asleep? I don't know.
Yeah.
So maybe they were on the surface and they thought by going underground would help them survive.
Yeah.
All right, I think that's it. Continue on.
Anyways, so we've, up to this point, we've kind of said Malachi, the scientist guy, pretty nice guy, right? He seems to be one that functions with logic, and he's a little bit more kind-hearted than Restak. He's the one that gets the elder lizard guy up and starts the discussion. He frees Elliot. He seems like a pretty nice guy.
Yeah.
Until you step back and you think of when he explained to the Doctor that he's slowly been stealing children and slowing the speed of their development to watch them grow. He's kind of creepy. he just still steals children. Over 300 years, he's stolen children and kept them. He's a creepy dude.
Yeah, I think their race in general was not doing right by the humans. I think they saw us like, I'm in that world. They saw the humans as the enemy, you know, as a threat, as, you know, who came and invaded their Earth that, you know, they used to habitate. And so I don't know, they don't know much about humans, so maybe they do look them as kind of like a lesser species. So they are doing research and, you know, taking their ape children and, you know, studying them. I don't know, like, not that I'm justifying his actions, but, you know, he seemed like the nice one of a group of people that were all very
watching
misguided.
Us evolve.
Yeah.
Going from apes to hairless apes.
Yeah. Yeah, so I definitely thought out of all the characters we're introduced to on the human side of things, the most interesting was the mother and kind of her predicament, feeling like she needed to save her son. And then not even just beyond that, you know, she kills Alea.
Yep.
You know, trying to get information to save her family. And then when they do go down to talk to the lizard people, she sets up kind of a backup plan to destroy them with a drill, right?
Yeah.
So it's she's, even though she kind of knows she made a mistake, she's still kind of all in, and it's all about, I guess, saving her family.
Yeah. And I mean, we look at that decision and it's like, okay, why in the world did you set the drill? But at that point in time, what else was going to get them out of that situation other than the fact that the drill was set? Like, the Doctor still fried all of their guns. But the drill kind of gave them a little bit more of a, I don't know, it seems like it helped out a little bit.
it was the distraction that led them to being able to escape. You know, not that the ends justify the means, but, you know, I'm sure the doctor would have found another way. And I think in the end, if you kind of back it up, if she had never killed Alea and they had peacefully brought her back, then maybe there would have been a chance for the two races to come to an agreement.
Oh, yeah. I mean, definitely.
So I think she, you know, although she had the best of intentions trying to get her family back, she did, she met the situation with violence, which I think Doctor Who in general, you know, the Doctor is very anti-violent. You know, he's anti-gun.
Yeah.
You know, he, you know, I guess the moral to the story is violence doesn't lead to good resolution.
Yep.
So, you know, although she had the best of intentions in trying to save her family, she went about it the wrong way, and it caused, you know, the end of a possible truce between these two races.
And they set it up even in the first episode, because as they were preparing for the Silurians to come to the surface and still not sure what they were, she's gathering up all the tools, and the Doctor sees that she has a gun, and he says, don't. And so they kind of set it up that she's leaning more towards that direction. But then the Doctor, as you mentioned, he's not one to brandish a weapon. He's not one to resort to violence. He's not one to go that route. And then to watch her slide down that slope to, in the end, when push comes to shove, she pulls back out the weapon. She kills Alea. And then she takes it one step further and almost destroys an entire civilization. Although she doesn't destroy the civilization, she definitely causes a major fraction between two that were going to be reconciled. And again, the Doctor deals brutally with her. The grandpa tells the son not to judge his mom. She tried to do what she thought was best. There's really no resolution for that character, is there? Like, she's, the episode ends and she's still a terrible person.
Yeah. Yeah, she's not as redeemable as some other characters have been.
Yeah, yeah.
Based on her decision making, but a good mother, I guess, right?
She she stuck up for her kids and Mo.
The instinct to protect your child, I guess, is very strong.
Yep.
And though, I guess, kind of speaking of her son, he really wasn't. You know, he kind of was a bigger part of the first episode, but kind of wasn't really used at all in this episode. He had a couple lines at the end, but, you know, that's pretty much it.
I love how chill he is about absolutely everything. Like, when bodies are disappearing from the grave in the first episode, he's just like, only explanation is they're getting eaten, quotes Sherlock Holmes. Then he's kind of just like run around setting up for the invasion, not too concerned about anything. Then he wakes up underground, surrounded by lizard people, and he's just like, hey, it's cool. The Doctor's like, I'm sorry. And he's like, you know what? I forgive you. It's okay. Like, he's just totally chill.
So, I don't know. What else happened here? We have the father who is, he got poisoned.
Yep, he's going to slowly turn into a lizard person.
Is that what they were saying?
He's mutating.
They said he was mutating. They never really said what the mutation was going to become, right?
Yeah, no, they definitely didn't. I just assumed he was becoming lizard.
Because that would be interesting. They didn't go down that path very far, but it would be interesting if part of the Silurians' plan was that they were going to go up and convert humans into lizards, kind of Cybermen-esque. But, you know, they didn't really explain the extent of, you know, him being poisoned and what that mutation was going to become.
Yeah, no, they never did. I just, yeah, I guess based on the color of the venom, it is really weird though, right? Like, why? Yeah, I don't know. I just kind of assumed he was mutating, and he said he was going to be a freak, so he'd stay down there to see if the decontamination worked. And then Nazreen Chaudhry, she decided to stay. It's all very sweet. And
which
touchy.
He had like a cool like chair thing that he was going to sit in for his time in hibernation. But I was like, where are they going to put her?
She's just going to hug him.
She's going to hug him.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was set up for two.
They're just going to spoon.
Joke's on them when they find out.
Sorry. Guess what?
There was only enough oxygen for one. I told you guys before you decided to stay. Yeah, that was kind of a forced romance, I thought. I never really bought. There was kind of the comment in the first episode where they kissed each other, and then she was it her that looked surprised, and he's like, "Oh, don't act like you didn't already know."
Yeah, yeah.
And then they kind of, you know, no big deal. She didn't seem that concerned about him, you know, as she was hanging out with the doctor. And then at the end, she decides to basically give up the rest of her life to stay with him. I was like, I don't know. I didn't really buy into kind of that romance there.
Yeah, I'm kind of torn whether she gave up going to the surface for him or just because she was excited about lizard people.
Yeah, like the scientist, you know, side of her is just like, oh, this is an opportunity that, you know, even though I might have to wait however long until I wake up from this hibernation, I'm like in the, you know, I'm discovering a new species here, you know, which is something like, most scientists would never have the opportunity in their lifetime.
Like she mentioned the whole idea of like, this is my life's work and I'm finally here and you're blowing up my drill. And it's like, there's nothing back for her up on the surface. So she's just going to stay down there. Which is funny because they didn't at all ask anybody about it. They're just like, no, we're staying.
Yeah, right. Do you mind if we use one of your hibernation chambers?
I mean, they did.
They had some spares, I'm sure.
So. Yeah.
there were some dead lizards. So
two lizards are dead, so they might as well. No, three, because Malachi died. So there's three dead lizards by the end of it. They have enough room for two people.
So speaking of dead lizards, yeah. So we have Restak, who knew that the poison was coming, and for, I guess, just based purely on revenge, she decides to not go get back into stasis, and she chases down the doctor and his friends right before they're about to get back on the TARDIS, right?
Right.
And then, like, this is the part that was completely unexpected for me, because I don't really remember this episode that well, but I remembered basically kind of what happens. And then this happens. She shows up. She shoots at the doctor. Rory jumps in front of the doctor and takes the bullet and dies. And I was like, whoa, I forgot about this. Like, yeah. I was not emotionally prepared to watch Rory die tonight.
I'm totally there with you. Like, it has to be a week ago I watched The Lodger. Okay. And that's an episode very doctor focused. Amy's on the TARDIS by herself. And it never hit me why she was by herself. And like, it never caught on. After watching this and seeing that Rory died, I went back through all the episodes that follow, and it's Van Gogh, The Lodger, and then the Pandorica opens. And it's like, that totally explains why Rory's not in Van Gogh, and that totally explains why Rory's not in The Lodger. And there's like, yeah, I totally forgot it happened. I was floored. Like,
I remember, because there's kind of like a joke, you know, with Doctor Who, you know, in general, like Rory is always dying. So I knew, like, you know, there's different situations that Rory dies, you know, in different episodes. And I knew this happened. I knew he died. I knew the whole crack in the wall, you know, kind of absorbed his body and erased him from time, and Amy forgets about him. I knew it. I knew it happened. But I didn't remember it happened in this episode. You know, it just seems like, you know, something I thought happened in a completely different storyline. And so when it started happening, I was like, whoa, like, this is not at all when I remembered this happening. And there's a lot of the episode left, you know, you kind of think it's ending, and then suddenly you have this whole situation where Rory dies, he disappears, and the doctor's like trying to keep him in Amy's mind, and it gets real, you know, it gets real intense, it gets real emotional. And like, this is the part where I was like, what? Because the doctor reaches into the crack in the wall and pulls out the shrapnel, which he ends up seeing as part of the TARDIS, and all the stuff that I remember, it's all like kind of, as it's happening in front of me, as I'm watching this, it's all coming back to me.
Yeah.
How important this scene is to the entire run of Smith's Doctor. I mean, all up and right up until he regenerates, the crack in the wall comes back. And it was like, oh yeah, this is the way Moffat used to tell stories. You know, this is,
yeah, exactly.
This is like that thread that, you know, ever since the beginning with Amy, he meets her, the crack in the wall, you know, all the way up until the end when he regenerates, you know, that was a thread all the way through. And this was a pivotal moment in that storyline where, you know, Rory is erased from time.
Yeah. I'm right there with you. Like, it was a brilliant reminder at the storytelling that we had with Matt Smith, and a stark comparison to it doesn't feel like we have those crazy arcs that we have with Capaldi. We had the hybrid, but even that, the hybrid to me in series 9 seemed very much of just this, like, it showed up like twice at the beginning, and then we might have heard about it once in the middle, and then all of a sudden it came at the end, but it wasn't satisfying. Like, the crack in the wall that shows up, the storytelling that we had with Moffat, there was something so much more substantial to it. And maybe it's because they killed Rory. Maybe it's because of things like that. Like, the TARDIS blew up. And yes, it's a crazy situation with resetting the universe. And it really makes very little sense the more that I think about it. But there were huge, weighty things that happened. And you can call me out on my fandom. Maybe I'm a terrible fan. I totally forgot Rory died. Like, when I remembered the crack in the wall, I was trying to figure out how Rory then shows up at the Pandorica. And the only thing I could reconcile in my mind is, oh, the crack sucks him in. I didn't remember Rory dying. I thought, like, he just got sucked in. So, yeah, my mind was blown when I watched it.
Yeah, I think this kind of illustrates what's good and bad about Moffat's storytelling. I think he's tried. I feel like with the whole crack in the wall thing leading up to the Pandorica and everything, I felt like that was Moffat at his best. And I think he tried to recreate it with things like the silence, you know, where he'd kind of drop in, you know, that term, and, you know, it kind of led up to what it led up to. And then you had, you
the know, fields of Trenzalore.
Yeah. You have Missy, you know, kind of popping into the end of episodes until it leads up to, you know, the reveal of who that was.
That one was good.
With Heaven.
I'm going to give that one to him.
Yeah.
That one was good.
That kind of stuff. And then even with, you know, Lady Me and the whole lead up until the kind of the end of time type thing with her, and kind of dropping in the hybrid and kind of the mystery behind all that. So, I mean, it's definitely Moffat's style. You know, this isn't something that is a kind of standalone thing that he did. He continued to do this type of storytelling, but I felt like this was the best. And I think you might have nailed it with Rory, you know, the fact that Rory did die, and there was that emotional connection that most fans had to that character. And, you know, they kind of joked with him dying before that, but this was for real. You know, he disappeared, and you have this big emotional moment with Rory, or with Amy and the doctor. And then she just forgets about him. And the doctor has the ring, and he's kind of hiding it from her so she doesn't see it. And then if you go on and watch the next, you know, couple episodes, which I did, you know, he's gone. You know, as a fan, when you're watching the show at the time, if you're watching it live and you don't know what's happening, to you, Rory's gone, you know. And so when he does come back with the Pandorica, that's a big deal. You know, the character's back. So I think, yeah, I don't know. Like, it was really exciting for me, just to kind of remind me of, you know, the impact of what we just watched tacked on to the end of a story about lizards.
I know, like, I can't say it any better than what you did, that you nailed it. It's a solid, solid, solid ending to an episode. I don't know if there's anything for Chibnall to take away from that, would be willing to make big, stinking, crazy moves. Even if you kill off a character, let it happen, and we'll see what comes of it.
Right. And I mean, this is a Chibnall episode, but I would probably, go out on a limb and say that story element was probably an overarching part of the story that was already set in, kind of as Chibnall took on the writing of this episode, I think that that was probably more dictated to him than him deciding to make that big of a risk. But yeah, it was a cool ending, cool enough for me. Like I said, went ahead and watched the next episode with Vincent and the Doctor, which still stands up as probably one of my top five Doctor Who episodes of all time. Yeah,
easily.
And rewatching that last night reminded me why. But yeah, just kind of seeing Amy without Rory and kind of little things that, you know, Vincent kind of calls her out at one point, like, why are you so sad? And she's like, I'm not sad. And
yeah,
he's like, well, then why are you crying? And like, she literally, like, with a smile on her face, had a tear and had no idea why she was crying, because, you know, she's got this lingering loss of someone that she doesn't even know she lost, which
so many brilliant moments. So just, I mean, this is probably a discussion for another time. It would be interesting to go back through and pick up on those story elements and see if Moffat strikes out more than he hits home runs. Because I would say, okay, Lady Me, yeah, that was good. Missy, probably. This one, definitely. But the other ones that we mentioned, as far as the Fields of Trenzalore, the Silence, like, those weren't as satisfying. He tried the same thing. I'd be interested to know, are they more brilliantly planned out, or are they just catching lightning in the bottle when they work?
Yeah, and sometimes too, like, as much as I enjoy the Pandorica stuff and the crack in the wall, there were elements of it when it got down to it that I do feel like Moffat kind of wrote himself into a corner. And so even the resolution of kind of Amy wishing the universe back into existence, you know, at her wedding, that has always bothered me. You know, it's kind of that they got to a point where there was no solution to the problem. Like, the universe, you know, the stars are gone, you know, the Doctor is gone, and she literally just wishes everything back into existence. You know, she thinks it and it happens, you know, kind of, which has always been an issue for me. Like, it seems like a cheap cop out. So yeah, you have the good and the bad, you know, where Moffat weaves in these really cool intricate stories, but then when you get down to it, you're like, oh, that's the resolution? Or even, you know, when it kind of finally resolves with the regeneration of the Doctor and the on the other side of that crack were the Time Lords, and they gifted the Doctor more lives, and you're like, oh, okay, that was a lot to lead up to that, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, it wasn't perfectly executed, I don't think, but just the ride, you know, the ride to get there is fun. You know, just to catch that, you know, the crack in the wall. Like, I remember in one episode, you kind of see it on the screen, you know, and somebody's like, oh, what's that? And he kind of turns it away, you know, like, it was always that mystery. You're wondering, oh, what's happening? You know, what's this? Why is this crack still following him? Which I think, even though maybe the resolution wasn't satisfying, it was just kind of the journey to get there was the fun part.
So I'm wondering if the ultimate resolution that we see where the Time Lords show up, if that wasn't more of a tack on, and the real resolution was the TARDIS blowing up, because there's that huge gap between the TARDIS going off and then when the crack finally shows back up again.
It did seem kind of like a tack on, like, almost, you know, Moffat's way of being like, oh, people really seem to like that, you know, maybe we'll throw that in at the end.
Yeah, or as we already mentioned, like with Tennant, how those elements all came back at the end and he was able to say goodbye. That was a huge part of Smith's story. And so it feels like it's just one of those things where it's like, oh, Smith is going, might as well throw in another crack just for old time's sake.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, really, it felt like we already had resolution to that. This new crack, yeah, it didn't seem like it should have been there at all. But
yeah, that's true. I would definitely agree with you there. But yeah, so overall, I don't know, kind of getting back to Yeah, it seems like we've really focused in on that those last few minutes of the episode.
We focused in on Moffat when we're supposed to be talking about Chibnall.
Yeah. Well, it was just, to me, that was the powerful part of the episode. It really was. You know, the story with the Silurians and everything that happened between those two episodes, I do think were fun, you know, good stories to watch. And I did enjoy the two episodes, but really for me, that kind of the thing that happened with Rory at the end, just maybe because I wasn't expecting it, it really just blew me away. And, you know, it was like, okay, that really made watching these two episodes exciting for me.
Yeah, I agree. That's, I would go back to something that I said in the previous podcast, is that we had so many Doctor moments, and I'm not just thinking of Matt Smith moments, but like great sound bites that only the Doctor could say, whether it's Eccleston, Tennant, or Smith, or even Capaldi. We had so much of those things just shoved into one episode again that I did enjoy the episode even outside of the last 5 minutes. But those last 5 minutes crystallized this episode. I don't think this episode is forgettable in my mind any longer. So the Chibnall part of it, I'm still all thumbs up based on these two episodes for Chibnall. I'll count 42 as being a fluke. At this point, but based on these two, I'm still excited to see what Chibnall can do. These two episodes were tops. I still don't feel like we have resolution as to why Amy was back on the cliff when she said goodbye, but I don't know.
Yeah,
about
I
that.
Think that was just to show us that time had changed. I really think that's the only reason why they ever showed. They showed him there at the beginning, kind of to establish like, oh, 10 years in the future, they're still together. They're still alive.
Yeah.
And then at the end, we see, because of what happened to Rory, we see that time has changed and time can change. This wasn't a fixed point in time. So what happened to Rory had an effect.
There you go.
You know, so
you just reconciled that for me and that all makes sense. And that's brilliant. That answers my question from the first episode, as far as what in the world happens there.
But yeah, so I think we've watched three Chibnall episodes now, and two out of three ain't bad, right?
Hey, so that's what we call a typical Doctor Who season, right?
Yeah, yeah.
When you can get slightly more than 50% episodes that are enjoyable, that's a solid season.
So we have two more Chibnall episodes. And I think you said you had kind of already watched one that had surprised you as being better than you had remembered.
Yep, it was better than I remembered.
That one, to me, The Power of Three,
yeah,
was another one that it's very forgettable. I actually don't remember at all what it's about, so I'll be excited to watch it again because it'll almost feel like watching it again for the first time.
Yeah,
because I don't remember anything about it.
Well, I won't spoil it for you. I'm not going to say any of my initial thoughts on it just yet, but it surprised me.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that being a forgettable one, the next one, Dinosaurs in a Spaceship, to me was not forgettable, but I do remember just not liking it. So, and, you know, upon a rewatch, I may change my mind with, you know, enough time has passed that I might look at it through a different lens. But
yeah, yeah. I think I watched majority of that episode with my eyes rolling. Okay. So maybe now I can sit down and watch it, and I'm thinking that there might be enough moments. I've seen clips, I've seen GIFs, I've seen little memes pop up from that episode, and it's been like, oh yeah, that's a funny line. Oh yeah, that's a cool moment. I'm thinking that there might be enough of those in that episode where it wins me over.
I think there's a Triceratops that acts like a dog. So. But Rory's dad is in it, which I always thought he's one of those characters that, although the episodes he was in, I didn't necessarily like that much, the character I did like. So I am looking forward to seeing that character again.
That's one of those things that sticks out to me. Is like there was something I was reading where it was like about doesn't every 30-year-old man or doesn't every grown man carry a trowel in his pants? And it's just like, that was his dad. Like, that was Rory's dad. Or I'll put one on your Christmas list and I'll get it for you. And it's like, Rory's like, I'm a 30-year-old man. I don't have a Christmas list. And it's just moments like that where it's like, okay, maybe I will enjoy this episode.
All right. Well, that's our next two episodes, I believe, unless something else comes up, we'll be covering those last two episodes of Chibnall. And then we'll have to decide where we go from there.
Yep. Sounds good.
All right, so I think we are good to wrap this episode up. As usual, you can leave us a review on iTunes. If you listen to our podcast and you enjoy it, we would love for you to head over to iTunes, leave us a nice 5-star review. You can follow us on Twitter, at Bad Wolf Podcast, Facebook, Bad Wolf Radio. Just search for that. You will find us. We are the one with the black and white logo. You can send us an email anytime, badwolfpodcast@gmail.com. And until next time...
Later days!